Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Welcome back to another Books with Hooks. It's going to be a super special one today because we have our author joining us. Welcome, Kelly Fuller.
I am so excited to be here and to talk to you three wonderful ladies. Thank you.
We're excited to chat with you too. We always love bouncing ideas off of authors and getting to brainstorm. For our listeners, Kelly did a really funny reel just before we taped to say how nervous she was. It was really cute. Find her on socials and check that out as well. Right, Kelly, will you please kick us off with your query letter?
Dear Carly and Cece, the service you two and Bianca provide through your podcast is invaluable to me and other writers. Thank you for helping all of us improve our craft and better understand the publishing industry. I am interested in working with either of you because of your history selling books with complicated, women-focused narratives. Before He Was President is an upmarket book club novel with series potential, complete at 120,000 words. A story within a story, it alternates between a fictional first lady memoir and the former president reading his wife's unpublished book. People who like an in-depth look at the making and breaking of a relationship, like Kennedy Ryan's Before I Let Go and David Nicholas's Us, will appreciate this story. It will also appeal to book club readers who enjoyed Michelle Obama's Becoming. Ever since leaving the White House, Josh St. James has grappled with his identity. He's no longer president, but he's not exactly a regular family man, leaving him unmoored. Meanwhile, his wife, Annie, is thriving in her new roles as a foundation member, writer, and mother. When Josh bails on the family vacation because he's behind on his memoirs, Annie reaches her breaking point. In a last-ditch attempt to get through to him, she slaps the first part of her own memoirs onto his desk, takes their kids, and leaves. Annie's recollections of their early relationship capture the people they used to be. She was guarded and hyper-independent. He was self-assured and naively optimistic, a far cry from the people they have become. As Josh reads, he is surprised by how their memories diverge, and it's clear they ascribe importance to different moments. Yet he falls in love with her all over again, especially when he finds notes she left him in the margins of the manuscript. But with tensions mounting through their text exchanges and terse phone calls, it leaves Josh wondering where it all went wrong and if they will end up the first presidential couple to divorce. I live in Wyoming with my husband, two kids, and bonkers rescue mutt. Indie It Press published a short story of mine in October 2022, and I've read more than 36 memoirs in the past 2 years. I also share facts about the real first ladies every Friday on Instagram, at Watch Her Write, with hashtag First Lady Friday. Thank you for your time. May I send you the full manuscript? Sincerely, Kelly Fuller. P.S. This query letter is 408 words, but if you remove the personalization at the beginning, it is 356 words.
Wonderful, Kelly. Thank you. And it was lovely to hear your pooch weighing in there, cheering you on. That's always wonderful to get your pooch's support. Okay, we're now going to hand it across to Carly.
All right. Thank you so much. You did such a professional job reading query letters. We got to get you back on reading every week. You were very smooth and very practiced. So great job, Kelly. Okay. I think you know the first thing I'm going to say, which is this is long. It is 120,000 words, which is long. I mean, you do say it's a story within a story. I don't think that gives it an excuse, though. So I do think there's some structural things. And obviously, it's great that you're on the show so we can get into that and chat with you about actually what the structure looks like and how we can possibly suggest improvements there. I really like the title. I think this is a really strong title. I like the concept. I think it's really fun and really unique. But I do think the structure, it's one of those structures where I want you to pull it off. I want you to be able to pull it off. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, I get pitched a lot of things that are kind of overly creative and I never know whether they're, you know, going to be able to execute them. So I have, you know, that kind of reservation in my mind to be like, is this person going to be able to pull it off? But it is a really interesting hook. Now, in terms of the comps, so I definitely think you have to cut the Michelle Obama becoming line. Not that it's not true, but if I was going to do something like that to nod to an actual first lady, I would probably be comping Curtis Sittenfeld's The American Wife or Rodham. And The American Wife's pretty old at this point. So if there is a more modern version of that, I mean, maybe I'm just not up on the comps in that space. I'd be looking at that. Rodham, I don't think is that old, but it's not obviously, you know, last year or anything like that. So it's something to think about how to kind of pull in a fiction comp in that space without talking about Michelle Obama, because obviously she's in a league of her own for good reason, right? Which you know. But yeah, that's kind of my notes on the comp situation. Okay, and so my next kind of question about the body paragraph is how much of this is premise slash backstory, or how much of this is on the page and how much of this is kind of the inciting incident? Mostly just out of curiosity, not that, you know, your query letter is doing anything wrong, but I'm thinking, are you, again, spending this word count telling me something I'm going to just need for a reference? Or are you telling me the actual plot of the book? Because if you're not telling me the actual plot of the book, I really only have the second paragraph here of what actually happens in the book. And again, it's all, you know, moving back in time. And that is set backstory. So it feels like a novel of backstory. And whenever I get pitched a novel of backstory, I'm always thinking, why did we go back and tell us that story? Why are we choosing to tell it in this structure? Why does it have to be this way? What is propelling us forward in the current moment? I don't think that a presidential memoir deadline is enough of a forward momentum. I think there has to be consequences to him not meeting the deadline. So I'll be honest with you, deadlines get moved all the time. And even for regular writers, not even, you know, presidents. And so it could be a case of the deadline has been moved 3 times, or he's had to move publishers for some sort of situation. I'm trying to say, like, I think the stakes have to be a lot higher than he missed his deadline, because a lot of people miss their deadlines. And especially for presidents, publishers are willing to move things around based on their busy schedules and things like that. Or it could be maybe, and you might have already thought of this and I'm just, you know, catching up. It could be if he doesn't get the book to them by the deadline because it's his third missed deadline, they're going to set him up with a ghostwriter. And he doesn't want to be set up with a ghostwriter. He wants to write his own book. Do you know what I'm trying to say? It has to be something like there's a reason for this. I don't think just missing his deadline is enough, personally. I really like the concept. Like, I think it's really sweet that, like, he falls in love with her all over again and the notes they leave each other in the margins. But I think the biggest question is what's at stake here, right? In terms of whether the book gets delivered or not, and with the other marriage, right? Because you leave us with Josh is wondering where it all went wrong, if they will end up the first presidential couple to divorce. What's at stake if they do, right? Is it just optics? I mean, obviously it's the, you know, the love of their lives. So I think we really have to amp up those types of stakes. I think that would be pretty important. So in terms of the author bio paragraph, I would cut the read more than 36 memoirs in the past 2 years. I don't really think we need that note, but I really like the First Lady Fridays on Instagram. I would definitely keep that.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, we're handing it over to you.
Carly was going over all of my points, so I will not spend any time saying that I agree, but I very much do. I think for me, two things stand out. One, you said that you wanted to work with us because of our history selling books with complicated women-focused narratives, which is like, yay, because I love complicated women-focused narratives. But I don't see this story being framed as that. If anything, it's his story. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's Josh's story. It's the story of him going from someone who's clueless and not seeing his wife and not realizing all the things he's not realizing, and I've read the pages, so I don't want to get into that. And I imagine that his arc is, oh my gosh, he then sees the light, right? Like, he then realizes all the things, but is it too late? That sounds like Josh's story. That doesn't sound like her story. And maybe the pages aren't like that, but then the query letter needs to reflect that, because it's strange to get pitched complicated women, yay, and then like hear all about Josh. When it comes to the plot paragraph as well, this is my second point. I do wish there was more plot with causality in a way that led to a climax. The way the story is framed right now, it feels like a character deep dive, like a deep dive into a relationship, who they were then versus who they are now, with the question of whether or not they'll make it. And that makes it seem very quiet. You are not pitching me a quiet book. You're pitching us upmarket, right? Like, so it's supposed to be pacey. And especially given that you're telling me 120,000 words, like, here's the thing. Some books do need to be 120,000 words. It's true. Some books require that many words. Some books just require that the authors compress. So instead of having one scene of backstory, one scene of plot forward tension, one scene of character development, take those three scenes and make them into one, right? And I don't know where you fall because I haven't read your entire manuscript, but you're already, I don't want to use the word red flag because that's dramatic, but any agent who gets this is already going to be like, whoa, 120. Okay. And then, whoa, story within a story. Hard to pull off. Okay. And then to add the fact that I don't see plot with causality, that makes it really hard. So I did want to be honest about that. I love stories like Rodham, like American Wife. You know, I really, really love them. So it's a cool, interesting premise. It's very ambitious. Lots of potential. But at the same time, because of how ambitious it is, I have to be honest about all the challenges and all the work that I think you have ahead of you.
Right. Thank you, Cece. We'll hand it over to Kelly in a moment. Yeah, you know, I've just handed in a book that at the end, I think when I sent it to my editor, was 117,000 words. And I set out to write an 80,000 word book, but I kept getting told this needs to be expanded. Add this. So a book needs to be as long as it needs to be. But yeah, you know, you don't want to be creating red flags, which create resistance. Right. We're handing over to Kelly now. Kelly, I'm really interested for you to answer for us what happens on the page as opposed to what's backstory, answering those questions of Carly's in terms of structure. And then, of course, you get to ask us questions too.
Yeah. So this is exactly why I wrote into you guys, because the structure of the novel, I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but I haven't found another book that's similar. And so I, like, reading back cover copy hasn't helped me because I have yet to find a book that follows this. But the reason why I struggled so much is because the bulk of the novel is Annie's memoir. It's her first draft memoir. So there's stuff in it that she even says when she leaves him notes, like, okay, I probably won't leave this in here, but I wanted you to have it, kind of thing. And so there's two timelines. Josh is in 2030 and their marriage is in crisis. And yes, he's behind on the deadline, but the overarching thing is that homeboy is having a midlife crisis big time because he's reached the pinnacle of his career and he's not even 50. Yet. And so it's very much like, and now what do I do? So he's been going through that. And Annie, in the 2030 version of Annie, is like, I need you to get it together because we have young kids. I have my stuff going on and you're not pulling your weight at this point. And then it goes back, and all of Annie's is just through the memoir. And that's the history of their relationship from 2014 when they meet until the end of 2020 after he's been elected to be president. And so that's why it's so long. I'm in the middle of another revision right now because I am trying to chop it down. I have followed all of your social media posts and I have the craziest spreadsheets and Word docs. And do I have interiority? Am I doing A, B, and C in each chapter? No? All right, then it's going. And so I am trying to get it down further than it is. But yeah, it's one of the questions I had is like, is this too ambitious for a debut novel because of the way that it goes? But yeah, so there's Annie, which is the bulk of it. And then there are little epistolary elements where they kind of leave notes for each other. And then there's Josh, and we only get his perspective in 2030. So you don't get Annie's perspective in 2030 at all. You just see, hopefully, how annoyed she is through their interactions.
Yeah. So to answer the question about the, is this too ambitious for a debut novel? I don't think it is, but I will tell you what could get you in trouble is trying to commit too hard to this structure, and you've boxed yourself in with a structure, which if it's going well, that's great. If at any point it isn't working and you have to shoehorn things, and we can kind of see the shoehorning, that's where you're going to get yourself into trouble. And that's when you're going to kind of look like a debut author trying to shoehorn an interesting structure, you know, through this novel. That's, I think, where your trouble is going to be. But if you can execute this properly and perfectly, then I don't think it's too ambitious.
Something I want to mention in terms of the memoir pages, I think that is where it's make or break time for this novel, because you do not want those memoir pages to read like diary entries. They can't just be chapters of telling. So if you're managing to capture those memoir pages in the way of a really excellent memoir, and you said you've read a ton of memoirs, right, to prepare for this. So long as those are really reading like a true memoir, which reads like fiction, and you're dramatizing things and it's not just a bunch of telling, I think that you can really pull it off there. So in terms of all the memoirs you've been reading, is that why it wasn't just research on presidential campaigns? It was how somebody writes a memoir.
Yes. So that is exactly why I included the line in the author bio paragraph, because I was trying to show, like, I do understand what a structure of a memoir looks like. And especially I've read 5 first lady memoirs specifically. And that's actually been really fun because there are a couple of chapters where you read the memoir and then you get the note from Annie to Josh where she's like, okay, we both know that this didn't happen this way. And then it's like, oh, she lied about this. And we get his reflections as well of like, okay, so this is what actually went down. And so it's been fun because I always wonder that whenever I read memoirs, like, is this how it really happened? Or are they just trying to make themselves look good?
And I think that's another thing going in your favor is that this isn't just a normal person memoir. These are famous people, positions of a lot of power who had a really interesting life. And I have some notes on that in my pages and we can talk about that later. But that's what you have going for you is that they're not normal people and you can't ever make that memoir piece feel like they're normal people.
Another question I have in terms of the structure, Kelly, is so we're going to move backwards and forwards. He's going to read part of her memoir. We're going to come back to 2030. In his moments, how does his story keep moving forward in terms of the dominoes tipping over? Like, how does him reading that part of her memoir affect what's happening in his plot and create causality so that A leads to B leads to C to keep moving his story forward before he goes back into the past again? That's my big question.
Again, I'm going through chapter by chapter to make sure that causality is there. But that is my hope, is that as he reads things, his portion of it is very much how two people can experience the exact same thing and come away with totally different perspectives on it. And so it challenges him to rethink certain things and starts to kick his butt, for lack of a better word, into gear and realizing like, oh, I'm losing her because I haven't done XYZ, because I didn't realize that this is how she's been viewing things. And they do have like phone calls and text exchanges and stuff. And so you do see the tension in their marriage mount throughout it, because at first he's a little dismissive. So he reads the first two chapters of her memoir and he's like, well, of course she's already done with hers. She's writing a rom-com. Like, that's not, I'm writing about foreign policy and how this decision cost a lot of lives. And he's like, and she's just writing about how we met. And so he's a little dismissive at first, but then as he gets into it and you can see, she's like, okay, it's so wonderful that you're reading what used to happen and that you're seeing my perspective. But what are you going to do now to fix our current problems? And so like they do have fights on the phone and through text messages and things like that. But it is also, like Cece said, it is a very character-driven novel. I don't think I am capable at this point in my career of writing capital L literary novels, which I know that typically that's what this would do, which is why I was like, okay, there is some plot. And her big struggle in the memoir in the past is, am I going to give up everything that I've worked for to follow this man that I fall in love with his dreams? And so, and that, but it was really hard to write that in the query letter, because you already know that they get married at the top. And so I had some paragraphs that was like, Annie needs to decide, you know, what does she value most? The life that she has built for herself or the life that she could have with this man? And it's like, well, to use a Cece term, that's kind of deflating the balloon, because you already know that they get married. And so that's why I have the query structured the way it is. Yeah.
So just hopping in there, Carly and Cece, do you have suggestions so that we focus more on her in the query letter without there being these kinds of tension leaks?
One of the things I think you can do is focus on her making the decision about whether she wants to give up anonymity, whether she wants to give up the ability to go to Trader Joe's on a Saturday morning. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing here. Because it's one thing to be like, because a lot of women are going to be having that question of like, you know, in their own lives, right? When they decide to partner up potentially with somebody who is in a powerful role or makes a lot of money and therefore it doesn't make sense for them to work. Like, that's a common struggle of partnership, you know, in our era. But I think what you have to focus on is, again, I'll talk about this more in the notes, but what is unique about this story is their level of prestige and power and the kind of larger than life dynamics. That's what's going to elevate the story. That's what elevated The American Wife and Rodham, right? Like, that's what the elevating factor is. And I think you're focusing way too much on them as human beings, which they are, but that's going to be your grounding factor. You're not talking enough about them being at the highest level of society, which I think is important and something that you can elevate here.
I think you need a secret. Her memoir needs to have a secret that he has no idea about. And that secret needs to be revealed throughout the pages. It is not enough. I'm going to be very blunt here, very direct. It is not enough to have him learn about how she fell in love with him. And, you know, they see things differently. That is awesome. That is character development. That's so great. But it's not enough. It's essential. It's essential. Keep it. We need it. Sometimes I read stories that have the secret, but they don't have the character development. And I'm like, why am I reading this? It's all plot. There's no character. Right now, I think you're in the all character, no plot camp. I don't know for sure because I haven't read the memoir pages, but based on what you're describing me. So I think we need a big reveal, a big secret, something in her story that is plot driven as well. And I'm not saying like bombs need to go off, you know, that's not that kind of story, but we need plot. We absolutely need plot. And a secret would be awesome.
Just jumping in there, one of the things that I love Cece's idea, first of all, has just got me thinking, which is if you want to keep this as a love story, because this is kind of how you're positioning it, it could be that one of the bombs that's dropped is that potentially she was with somebody else before she met him, and there's like the love triangle element, and then she has to make a choice whether to be with him and give up a normal human life where she can go to Trader Joe's on a Saturday morning and be anonymous versus whether she wants to be with this person who's like skyrocketing through, you know, the political darlingship or whatever. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like, if you want to keep it romantic, that would could be something that you could focus on.
And also, if the secret has stakes that are somehow tied to his campaign or his career, then at the end, it's like, does he, I don't want to say allow her to publish her memoir, but does he have an understanding of her enough that he supports the publishing of this memoir or the secret or something, you know?
It's going to blow up their whole legacy, right? If she publishes something that's going to affect their lives and their kids' lives moving forward. Yeah.
I'm going to have to think about that because I don't know at this point what her secret could be. So I'll have to mull that over and think about it. She does have a very complicated family life. So that's why in it. And again, I recognize it's a character-driven thing, but that is definitely why she struggles to commit to their relationship. To go back to the comps, so I haven't used the Curtis Sittenfeld ones because of how old they are. American Wife would have been great, but I believe that was published in 2007 or 2008, and I was like, I think that's probably pushing it.
Yeah, I think Rodham, though, I think you could use Rodham. I think Rodham's only 5 years, and it would, like, accomplish the goal of being, like, Curtis Sittenfeld book, potentially.
Okay, Kelly, will you then give us an overview of what's in the pages, and then we'll discuss that?
Yes, I can certainly do that. It opens with Josh 2030, so we know whose point of view we're in, and we have a timestamp. He's sitting in his home office when his wife, Annie, walks in and slaps a binder on his desk, which she says is proof that it's not his family that is preventing him from writing his book. We learn that Josh is the former president of the United States and Annie is the former first lady, and they've both been working on their memoirs. But Josh is behind on his, so he is bailing on their family vacation to stay home. She makes one last plea for him to change his mind about the trip. And when he doesn't, she reveals that she knew he wouldn't change his mind. So they've already packed and they are ready to go, even though they weren't supposed to leave for a few days. Josh is surprised by the decision, but as they're saying goodbye, the kids just devolve into chaos. The youngest starts screaming and he's like, yeah, okay, this is why I need you guys to go so I can get my book done. He watches his family and their security caravan leave, but when he walks back into their home, the silence he's met with is a bit daunting instead of liberating.
Wonderful, Kelly. Thank you. Okay, Cece, I'm handing across to you first.
Thank you for that very excellent summary. You did such a good job. Okay, so this is going to be a very Cece-specific note. Don't feel like you have to follow it at all. Part of what I do is like, these are the things that were going through my brain as I read this. I don't know that I want to start with him. I think I want to start with her. Our brains, our reader brains, they imprint on the first character that we read, the first POV. And I wanted to start with hers. So that was me, but I'll still give you notes on this one because this chapter is still going to be here. But I really wanted to start with her. Anyway, I'm glad we have you on because you can tell me what her first chapter looks like afterwards. So, Kelly, I have a theory, and if I'm incorrect, I will drink Bianca's disgusting smoothie kale thing, because I'm sure I'm right. Seriously, I will drink the kale if I'm wrong. You want us to not like him. That is my theory, right? Like, in this first chapter, okay, then I'm drinking kale. Kelly, I hate this man. This man sucks.
Send an order over to Cece's house.
My husband's going to be so happy. He's always trying to get me to eat vegetables. Okay. This man sucks. Look at this. Annie, with her messy bun, tank top, bare feet, looked more like the stay-at-home mom she had become instead of the first lady she had been. What does that mean? He tells her these horrible, mean things. And in his head, he's not giving us any vulnerability, right? Like, I thought he was going to say the mean things, but in his head, we would see the conflict. We would see the messy emotions. We'd see that it was all pride, you know? And I'd be like, oh, okay, I feel for him, like mean. But she tells him that she had already packed and she knew how the conversation would go. And there's nothing in his head about, oh my God, like nothing. He's so mean and so
entitled and so privileged. And yeah, of course he's privileged. He's a former president. He's, I'm assuming, a white guy with lots of money and power. So of course he's privileged. That's fine. But you don't want us to dislike him? Because you're shaking your head, or you shook your head before. And how? How in the world are we supposed to like this human? He refers to the sounds she makes in the kitchen while she's cooking for their family as noise, as like the reason he can't get work done. Can he close the door to his office? Can he go like on a run? The Secret Service can accompany him to, I don't know. Like, he's so terrible. He's more considerate of his neighbors, because at least he's wondering what the neighbors think about the gate, than he is of his wife. Look at this. It would be another thing for Annie to get pissy about. Annie's kitchen playlist wasn't filling the first floor with music because she wasn't making lunch for him and the kids. Any gratitude about her making the lunches? Like, anyway, I thought for sure, and I'm going to have to drink a kale smoothie. I'm so sad. I thought for sure we weren't supposed to like him. And I was going to tell you, cool, unlikable works. But because we're in a situation where the unlikable character has so much power and so much privilege, we need vulnerability and the interiority. But now that you're telling me that we're supposed to like him, then I'm sorry. Then I just don't get it. I need explanations from you once we're done, please. Because I hate him. Like, I hate him.
I'm going to jump in here and I'm going to say I have a feeling that Kelly's done this in terms of his character arc. So to show him being really awful up front so that later, as they move closer together, we're going to see the lovely side of him. But the problem with that, Kelly, is that you can alienate the reader early on. And they're just like, I hate this guy so much, I don't want to stick around for his character arc. So I think what Cece was saying there in terms of the vulnerability, you do want to see the character arc. You do want to see him move from being one kind of person to being different at the end. But you still need to give us something to kind of find redeeming. That's because we're going to spend quite a bit of time with him, right? So that's something.
Just very quickly on that, if we are supposed to like him, then that can't be his arc. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I also thought the exact same thing, Bianca. I was like, this is his arc. He's going to go from unlikable, unaware, unchecked, to someone who has seen the light. You know, someone who has become sensitive and kind and seen his wife for what she is. But if we're supposed to like him, then that can't be the arc. It doesn't make sense.
Well, let's actually hop in now. Kelly, let's get your feedback immediately.
Yeah. So, and this is why in the query letter, I called it a book club book, because I'm hoping it generates this kind of discussion, actually. And so what I'm hoping for Josh is that you do start out like, okay, like, what's your problem? And then you realize like, oh, this isn't because you haven't finished a book. This is because you no longer know who you are. And I'm hoping the juxtaposition between past Josh in Annie's memoirs and current Josh sets that up. Because when you first meet him in her memoirs, when they meet in person, he's confident. He is very kind. He wants to talk to people. He is just Mr. I have a goal and I'm going to make it. And at first he's running for senator. He has to win that first before he goes on to be president. And so they meet when he's campaigning to become a senator. And so it is purposeful. But the other reason that I did it is that early beta readers were like, so we like Josh a lot more than we like Annie. And so I was like, okay, well, I guess I gotta flaw him up a little bit. And so maybe I've swung too far in the other direction.
I don't have to drink the kale smoothie.
But that's why it starts this way.
You're telling me that we are not supposed to like him.
No, you do. We're sending you a 3-pack order right now.
But I mean, so I've had 4 rounds of beta readers. So approximately 8 people read this. And most of them really love Josh, and it's Annie that they take issue with, which is why I had the line about complicated women-driven narratives, because she's, I'll be honest, she's not always likable.
Carly and Cece, so if we start with a character like this, and he has these horrible thoughts and he behaves in these certain ways, if we give him a degree of self-awareness when he says something and then sort of winces afterwards and is like, why did I say that? Or something like that. Does that help, do you think?
That was in my notes for sure. Yeah. The lack of self-awareness. Like, there's no way after being married to somebody for that long, you would either think that without remorse or, and the other thing is, we assume, I shouldn't say this blanket statement, we assume somebody who becomes president is a very intellectual, thoughtful, educated human being. And so he should know, even if something dumb comes out of his mouth, he should know intellectually, like, oh, that one's going to come back to bite me later. Or I don't want my children hearing me say that about their mother. Do you know what I mean? Like, there has to be something intellectually that he knows, even if he's saying stuff that feels a bit rote or feels a bit obvious, that he should know better. And yeah, that was definitely in my notes.
Cece?
So I 100% agree. And I would say that one of the ways to accomplish this is having him be self-aware with other people, especially his children. There's a part in here, very well-written part, where he's observing his children. And he's saying, you know, like, this is what typically happens. And their kids are calling out for their mom. And I'm wondering if maybe, for example, just as an example, during moments like this, we could see him think, I promised myself I wouldn't fight with my wife in front of my kids because my parents fought in front of me. And here I am breaking that promise. Or maybe he could think something like, they're not actually calling for her because they want her. They're calling for her because this is what they do when we start fighting. Because some kids do that. It's very common in families where they fight, where kids try to distract their parents. Look, mom, I drew a dinosaur. And it's not about the dinosaur. You know, the kid is trying to get their parents to stop fighting. So even something like that would go a long way because it would show that he thinks about other people and interprets and anticipates and projects and is just like, I guess, a more emotionally messy person. What he thinks instead is this was the reason why Josh hadn't gotten anything accomplished on his book. He can still think that, but yeah, I think he needs to think other things too. And if anyone maybe is wondering, well, you know, if he has so much self-awareness with the kids, but he doesn't with his wife, isn't that bad? There are situations in life where we have a blind spot with one person. And that's especially true if we harbor resentment for some reason, if we're the kind of people who keep score, like that happens. There are people who are great and actually quite sensitive and quite empathetic, but then they have a blind spot with one person or another during a certain period of time. And it might actually make sense in your story that she is his blind spot because of how their marriage is complicated. So I just really wanted the messy emotions. And by the way, I wanted even worse emotions too. Here's an example. When she confesses to him, oh, I already packed. I knew you'd say no. That is a manipulative thing to do. In that moment, I kind of wanted him to be like, she's manipulating me. You know, how dare she? She's setting me up for failure. Like, I wanted even worse emotions in his head. It's not just about having his interiority be sensitive. It's also about showing me his interiority be actually worse, but have him not say it. That would go a long way too, I think, in just making him, like, likable is not the point. Most of the books I like do not have likable people. It's vulnerable, that's the point. And vulnerability, it can only be achieved if you go deep into someone's psyche.
Yeah, you know, I know at moments when I'm the most stressed out of my mind and I become a real pissy little bitch, I know that even as I'm being a pissy little bitch, I feel terrible about it. And even in my head, I'm trying to walk it back. And it's like, oh God, why do I get this way? You know, this is not fair on these people. This is my shit. I need to get it sorted. So I feel like if you balance out some of that with him, we'll get a more complex character and certainly understand the push and pull. Because obviously big external responsibilities to the country, to the job, responsibilities to his family, and there might be things that he wants for himself that he's not getting because of all these responsibilities. So I think, you know, if you can really dig deep there, we'll see all those different layers. Carly, what else did you want to add about the pages? Because I think we started with CC and then we went off on a tangent.
No, it's good. I love tangents. That's where the magic happens. Okay, I had some questions about how old they are. So you said he's not yet 50. They have young children. I don't think we know how many. She has to be younger than him by a decade in order for them to biologically, presumably, have children and for them to be still of a young age while he's creeping up on 50. So I'm kind of interested in that dynamic a little bit, how old everybody was when they got into the White House. I also, at one point you say that potentially he's either been in the White House for two terms or somebody in his family was in the White House before he was in the White House, because you said the desk had been used twice. So I'm like, if it was him that was in for two terms, that's 8 years. She's 10 years younger than him. When did they have, like, I don't know. I just have a lot of questions and we could get all to that later, but that was something where I was like, okay, that was interesting to me. Again, don't have to deliver that in these pages exactly, but that was something that I was a little bit interested about. I think at the end of the day, and I mentioned this earlier and I said I was going to come back to it, the thing that just isn't elevating these specific pages for me is the fact that we are not adding a little bit of glamour. We need a little bit of glamour. We need to talk about the Secret Service agents earlier. I need to know how big their estate is. That's just kind of part of the territory when we're going to try to potentially market a book like this and a hook like this and how this is going to stand out. Again, this isn't any other family. This is a very special family. This is a family that means something to the country, to the world. And so we're missing an element of glamour that, again, this doesn't have to be over the top, but it could be something where, yeah, they have this like cozy estate that's like cottage-like, but I have no idea what this cozy cottage estate looks like. You know what I'm trying to say? We're just missing a huge opportunity to elevate in a more cinematic way, because I think there is this really interesting dynamic between them. And I like the hook and I like the structure, but I feel like we're seeing this still in its nascent stages. And so that's why I'm kind of like giving you as much feedback as I can, because I think this has the potential to be really interesting. And I would love to see the pages when you're done with them, because I think if you can execute on all these things that we're talking about, I think there's a lot of potential here. But I also just finished watching season one of The Diplomat, which is Carrie Russell's show. And I'm like waiting for season two. And they're not president roles, but they're ambassador roles. And it's like, it's really little things where it's like, they'll have people doing everything for them. They have cars pulling up for them, all this stuff. And it's just the little elements, and maybe glamour isn't the right word, but like of being in a higher echelon of society, that I think you're missing that layer that could really just bring that cinematic potential and bring some setting potential to this.
Yeah, something I was also thinking of was The Good Wife, where the husband had staff, right? There was someone who was always trying to manage the optics of what was happening. So I feel like if she was getting her staff to get them packed, whoever his aide was would know that she's busy packing to leave and would kind of warn him about it. So that, again, you feel the interplay that she wants to come and speak to her husband, but here is his staff member trying to manage the fallout of the situation. So you can show that they're not even properly able to interact with each other genuinely, and, you know, that they've got to work around this other person there who's managing the optics of it, which again would up the drama of the scene even more and give us insight into how much staff they have, how weird this kind of lifestyle is.
Yeah, so this is where, and I've heard other authors say this, this is where I wish you guys got the first 10 pages instead of the first 5. Because once he gets back into the house, he definitely compares where they're living now to the White House. And so I think there's one little line that you guys got in the first 5 pages about how their very own White House, but without the grand columns and the West Wing. But yeah, once he goes back in and like he has that moment of realization of like, oh, I said all I needed was quiet and now I have it and now I don't know what to do with myself. And so he actually does kind of wander a little aimlessly through the house, and that's where you get the pieces of like he stares out into the huge backyard with the big tree line and the pool. And yeah, but of course you didn't get those ones. And so, yeah. And I think that's just where I also struggled a little bit, is I know how important the first 5 pages are. So that's where I tried to put the drama. But yeah. So would you recommend I incorporate those things more in the first 5?
I would for sure. I also have some notes about, I actually think this interaction between them goes on too long. So I think that you can truncate that a little bit. You'll see in my notes, and everybody who gets the Substack notes will see. I think that we're essentially in one scene for the full 5 pages. So I think she should drive off in these first 5 pages for sure. Yeah. And I think we should be able to get some of that wrapped in there for sure.
Cece, coming back to what you said earlier about starting earlier with her, what suggestion do you have? Do you think it would work that as she's busy packing, we're with her and we see her getting everything packed ahead of we meeting him, especially if we're wanting to be sort of centering her? If this wasn't where you wanted Kelly to begin, where would you think another beginning might be that would factor in all of the drama and all of these things that we're talking about?
I guess it wouldn't make sense to have us see her pack, because Kelly has shared that her structure is, you know, past timeline, we get her POV, 2030 timeline. I shouldn't even say past, maybe it's 2024, but whatever. Like the past timeline is her POV, current timeline is his. I don't want you to have to change your whole structure unless that's something you want to do. It might just be her memoir. Honestly, we might just start with chapter one of her memoir. And then once he starts reading it, we figure out that he is reading that chapter, you know, like it could even be something like that. But you know, that, like I said, like that is a very CC specific note, because I am way more interested in stories about women than I am in stories about men. This is not anything against stories about men. It's just people gravitate to what they like. And this is typically what I like. And you pitched it as a complicated woman's story. And so because of that, I was like, can we see her first?
I don't think we can, though, because she's in the past, right? And then starting, that's essentially starting with backstory, which I definitely,
I don't think of it as backstory, though. I think of it as dual timeline. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, there's two books here. It's kind of like the ballerinas. When we start with the past chapter, and because we start with the prologue, but like other than the prologue, we start with the past chapter. We start with Delphine being 14. I don't know how old she is. And then we get present day chapter. Like, I don't think it's backstory.
I think it depends on what the first chapter is, though, because it's really hard, because if it's going to just be, I met my future soul, not that this is, I'm obviously making a terrible generalization, but like, I met my partner today on this blind date or whatever, you know what I'm trying to say? What that opening memoir section is incredibly important, because I agree with what Cece said earlier, is we attach to whatever the opener is. And so we're attaching with Josh right now, and obviously have a lot of feelings about that, but we will attach to whatever you open with. And I always worry opening in the past, even if it's a dual timeline, is that we're never fully caught up emotionally to the momentum and the dominoes tipping over that we need in the present. Because I think also as humans, we are in the present. And no matter what, backstory is always backstory. Past is always past.
Unless she reveals something, alludes to some kind of secret in that one. I mean, we were saying maybe she has a secret, maybe she drops curiosity seeds about that. Yeah, I don't know.
It's a random idea and it probably won't work, but it's an example of what I mean. What if, for example, it could be something like, if we were to open in her point of view, that she's on the estate that they currently are in, for example, right? Maybe she grew up in that house because it's a former governor's house or senator. You know what I'm trying to say? So maybe she grows up there and then we know where they are. And then in Josh's point of view, then we understand that's the same house. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like something where we're bringing it all together in a circular pattern immediately. If that's a bad example. You know what I'm trying to say? Of like, we're connecting the dots in a circular fashion really quickly. That's one example.
I think we've thrown so many ideas at poor Kelly that her brain must be spinning and I think she must be dizzy. Cece?
No, I just want to say that a lot of novels start with the past. Seriously, I'm looking through my list now. A lot of the ones I read start, it works. You can do it. If it's what you want. I don't think you should change it because I like to read stories about women. Like, that's a terrible reason. I want to know, though, from you, what is her first chapter? What scene are we in?
So the beginning has changed a lot from first conception. He originally wasn't going to have a point of view at all. It was just going to be a fictional first lady memoir. But then as I started getting more into it, I was like, oh, I really think I need both of them to tell this story to its full potential. So her first chapter is when they meet each other. But originally, once I introduced Josh's story, it started with a letter from Annie to Josh. And you guys don't have it. Again, it's in the first 10 pages, but not the first five, where she says, this is all the ways that I have fallen in and out of love with you over the years. I know this is not what can be published, but I wanted you to have this. This is our story. So I had that. There's a foreword from Annie where she's talking to the readers of her memoir. So there is some potential to start with her either with a letter or with the foreword. But when I had it with the foreword, too many people were like, no, this isn't, you can't open with this. Like, it's fine to have this information later, but it can't be your first thing. And then the letter, it just felt a little awkward going from the letter to his point of view to him then reading the memoir, you know. So I do hear what you're saying, because a lot of people were like, it's her story, you have to open with her. And it was like, yeah, but how? With the way the structure is.
How about, I mean, there's nothing to say that you can't begin the story with the very last chapter she writes in her memoir. There's nothing to say that because we're dealing with the memoir that we have to see the memoir in a linear time frame. Maybe there is something she concludes at the end that keeps us in suspense. Maybe she is like, I have now made this decision. We don't know what the decision is. We're curious about what the decision is. And then we realize he's about to read it and he's going to get to that part last. So that keeps us curious and reading to see what the big decision is that she's now going to tell him. That could be something we can begin with as the prologue. So also something to keep in mind. It doesn't have to be the memoir in a linear time. Right.
And it could be when she hands him the file. Like, I love that idea. And then she hands him the file and she's like, the answer to that question you had in 2015 is in here. You know what I mean? And then it's like, and then we build up to the answer. So yeah, I love Bianca's idea. Everybody has great ideas today.
Perhaps too many, Kelly. We're going to let you simmer with all of these afterwards. We've thrown a heck of a lot at you and you've taken it really, really well. But you can see we're super excited about the idea, which is when, you know, our synapses fire and we start to throw out all of these ideas. We are now, unfortunately, at the end of our time. So we have to thank you so much for joining us. You will get our notes, our written notes, and all of our Substack subscribers who support us there will get the notes as well. There were some line level comments that I made where Kelly was getting a bit confused between the use of a dialogue tag and an action beat when it came to formatting of that. And you'll just see me highlighting those just so that you can get those fixed, Kelly, and just for our listeners to see how to do that as well. Right, Carly and Cece, as per usual, thank you so much. Kelly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. This was very helpful. And I just appreciate you guys and the podcast and all that you do.
Thank you. And we look forward to seeing where this goes. Right. Let's go to today's guest.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky, though, to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Hello, listeners. This is Cece. Question for you. What do all the very best stories have in common? The ability to make us feel. Which is why learning how to weave emotions into your writing is so important. And I am so excited to announce that I am teaching my super popular writing emotion class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, August 8th. at 8 p.m. Eastern Time via Zoom to learn all about the craft of writing emotions, common mistakes, tips and tricks, and lots of practical examples from novels and memoirs you love. Then we'll meet again on Monday, August 12th for a live cozy Q&A session in which you will have the option to turn on your camera and ask questions in real time. If you can't attend one or both sessions live, make sure to sign up because everyone who is registered before August 8th will get recordings 24 hours later. For more information, head to my Instagram profile and click on the link in my bio. I hope to see you there.
Hello, everybody. It is Carly doing the interview today, and we have a very special author, somebody whose book I read and loved and really wanted to have them on the show. We have Vanessa Walters on the show. Vanessa Walters was born and raised in London, has a background in international journalism and playwriting, and is a Tin House resident and a Malay resident. She is the author of two previous YA books and The Lagos Wife, which was a Good Morning America book club pick, and currently lives in Brooklyn, New York. And we are here to talk about The Lagos Wife. I'm very excited for us to have this chat and finally have you on the show. Welcome, Vanessa.
Hi, Carly. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited too. I think we have so much to talk about. I mean, so first of all, if you guys aren't familiar with the book, which you guys all should be, it has such a rich setting. It has a whodunit. It has just like everything you want in a kind of upmarket thriller. So tell the listeners, if they haven't read the book, tell them about the title and how it came to be and everything about the book.
Sure. So The Lagos Wife is about a woman who marries a wealthy Nigerian and moves to Lagos. She's living a perfect life until one day she disappears. And the story is really about the mystery of this disappearance. It's told through the character who disappears, Nicole herself, but it's also told through the perspective of her aunt who travels from the UK to try to find her. So wrapped up in this whole investigation of her disappearance is also an exploration of family trauma, and on both Nicole's part and also the aunt's part. And yeah, so there's a lot of themes there to do with generational trauma. And Nicole's family is a British Caribbean family, so it's a lot about culture as well.
And that was, I think, one of the things that felt so refreshing about this book to me, because I'm like, and I've been in the book business 15 years, and I'm like, we see the same versions of the same books, you know, and they change over time. But your book felt just like, I don't know, a jump in a cold plunge of just like a different rich setting that we hadn't really seen before. And I love that you tackled things like feminism, you know, it being in a patriarchal society, and capitalism, colonialism, and you just smashed it into a thriller that was just an absolute page turner. So I just want to applaud you on such an incredible job, because I think also there's a lot of books where when we're trying to infuse some of those themes, there's like a feeling we have to teach the reader or bring them up to speed, but you assumed a certain, like, I don't know, accountability of the reader, and you just kind of baked that into the actual book itself. So tell us, how did you strike that balance of accomplishing that? Because it's very clearly you're very talented to be able to weave all of that in.
Oh, thank you so much. I don't really feel it's a question of talent, but just more the story I wanted to tell. I was really telling this story for a lot of personal reasons, because I was a Niger wife, and this story is also the story of the Niger wives in Nigeria. Nicole is a Niger wife. These are the foreign wives of Nigerian men who live in Nigeria. And I really wanted to talk about that Niger wife experience, but in a way, I was sort of doing it for myself. And I think that's why there isn't a ton of explaining, because in a way, the story was just kind of my exploration of what that experience is through Nicole as a fictional character. But these were really questions I wanted to ask. Like, for example, Nicole wonders how much she really means to this place, coming in as a foreign wife and living there for so many years. But who really cares about her? And, you know, what would be remembered if she suddenly disappeared, so to speak? So I think I really wanted to answer those questions for my own reasons. And that's why there isn't a ton of explaining. And honestly, I really never thought the book would be embraced on this level. And I'm just super thrilled to see how much people have loved it.
Yeah, I'm definitely one of those people. I want to ask you also about the title change. So I read a galley or an arc. Some people call it galley, some people call it arc, but the advanced review copy that I got from Atria, and it had the title The Niger Wife on it. And then I noticed you promoting, I think it's a paperback or the next edition, the UK edition, and it had The Lagos Wife on it. So do you want to talk about, you know, how books change titles or, you know, based on different locations or feedback or between hardcover and paperback? Because this has happened to one of my authors as well. So I'd love for you to breathe life into that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I have found out a lot during this process, including that it is quite common to change title and cover. So my UK publication and my US publication were almost a year apart. My US publication was May 2023. And so they were really going first and they chose a great cover. They really liked the title, The Niger Wife. When the UK publication came along, that was a different publisher. And they had already actually said when they bought the book that they were thinking more of going for a different title. They chose The Lagos Wife because they felt that the UK readership was much more familiar with Lagos, Nigeria as a place. And I think that's true. Nigeria was a former British colony. So they really wanted that title to speak to that familiarity. And then they went for this cover here. And when the US publisher saw the cover, they fell in love with that cover. And it's quite funny because they really loved the original cover too, but they really felt like the UK cover was fresh and edgy, and they decided to go with that cover. And I think as a part of going with that cover, they just thought they would go with the title as well. I do think that perhaps the title, The Niger Wife, was a little unfamiliar to the US audience. I did see some of that in some of the reviews. So I can totally understand why they also decided to try The Lagos Wife as a title too. I feel like The Niger Wife really speaks to the Niger Wife's experience, and my editor at Atria really felt so also. But I think it's just a question of, since we're changing the cover, shall we also change the title as well to just reflect, you know, should we just go the whole hog? And so that's what they've decided to do.
Yeah, it's happened to one of my clients before as well. We did a hardcover and then we're like, we're going to change the cover. I think we're also going to change the title. And it ends up being a different package. And some readers could be a bit confused because they're like, oh, is that a different book? But at the end of the day, you're trying to appeal to a different market and a new market and expand the readership. So it is a business decision that a lot of publishers definitely make. All right. So next question I have is around, I think one of the things that I especially loved about this book was the dual timeline, dual POV. Because a lot of authors will, you know, submit their work to the show and have it critiqued. And Cece and I are always thinking like, oh, what is the best way to tell a story? How can we kind of convey that? Sometimes you have to try a couple different ways of telling the story to figure out exactly the best way and what will serve the story. So do you want to just explain the dual timeline, dual POV, and how you kind of map that out in your head? Or did you always imagine that was how it was going to be?
Oh, no. I mean, this book started off almost as like a set of notes with me trying to sort of explain this life in Lagos just to people. I think I tried a blog at one time and there just wasn't enough space to say everything that needed to be said. And so I started with Nicole's POV, but then I realized I wanted to kind of explain not just how Nicole feels at this point in the story, but also how she felt or how Lagos would have appeared to her when she first arrived. And so Nicole was, I mean, Claudine, the aunt, coming to Lagos at the beginning of the story was just a great character to really interrogate those preconceptions we might have of a place like Nigeria. And then also that first almost like ridiculous sort of reaction that people have when they go to a different country and they interact with a new culture for the first time. So that's how I came up with the two POVs initially. And then it just grew from there. Claudine is also like the backstory, the embodiment of the backstory in the novel. And I think she's just been a great way to like interrogate family histories and generational trauma and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, you pulled it off. It worked because we're like trying to figure out obviously what happened to her. We want to know what happened to her when she's in Lagos, but then we also want to know why she got there in the first place. And Claudine answers all of that. But we need both stories. And I think whenever I'm explaining to authors, you know, somebody who wants to write multi-POV, it's always about why do we have to have both stories? Why is it absolutely essential to have, you know, both point of views or both stories? And I think this was just a perfect example of that. Okay, my next question is around Nicole's idea of mothering and motherhood and herself and her identity, because I think she's super interesting as a character because she is very lonely and she is very much just trying to like find herself in a new country after having kids. And that's like a double whammy of like an identity crisis. And I found her so interesting. And also, I think that we are in an era right now of very like intensive mothering. And it's like, you know, we have to be there all the time for our kids. And different cultures have completely different experiences of motherhood. And also classes, like, you know, in the class system, different classes of people have different experiences and expectations of motherhood. So I felt like she was such a good character to kind of analyze all of that through, which was so interesting to me. And so I don't know if you had, you know, any further thoughts I didn't kind of express on the page, but how you were trying to tackle that identity crisis she was having and her experience of motherhood and how you wanted that to show up on the page and whether you're trying to say something, you know, about our culture or class and motherhood. I'm just interested in your perspective.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you that Nicole's experience speaks to motherhood and feminism. I think that it is part of the Niger wives' experience that when you move to a patriarchal country like Nigeria, you're expected to really fit into their cultural idea of what motherhood is. And that is really that motherhood is your, you know, your whole reason to exist. It's a very exalted position in Nigerian society, which is one of the positives of being a mother in Nigeria. Everybody respects your motherhood, and they have a folk tune, which is a mother is worth more than gold that children sing at school. And it just speaks to how exalted this sort of institution of motherhood is there. But I think coming from a Western society, one of the things you go through is having your individuality sort of erased. And that is the point at which Nicole is at, where she's trying to figure out who she is. And I think it's to a certain extent, we go through this in Western society too, where for a few years, motherhood is like all encompassing, but then you're sort of spat out of it at some point. And you've got to find out who you are again. And as Nicole says, go back to living for you. And so that's something I really wanted to explore. It's something I think I've been through as a mom, and lots of women have been through. And I also didn't want to like cynically use Nicole's motherhood as a way to sort of get sympathy for her as a character. You know, that's why there aren't a ton of like tender moments with the children as such, because I really wanted people to look at her as an individual, as her own person, and judge her as her own person without getting into sort of tropes of like, you know, an idealistic idea of like what a mother should be.
I was just nodding along. I'm like, yep. Okay, now I'm going to quote you back to yourself for a minute here. So I read that you said, quote, "The book was inspired by the incredibly thrilling city of Lagos, which has a rich history and a diverse population. It's a place to which all sorts of people gravitate to seek their fortune. And inside that tension between success and failure, wealth and deprivation, optimism and despair, everyone has a story to tell. Mine happens to be about a Niger wife because that's the community I inhabited." End quote. And I've read a lot of books about social climbing, but I felt like this was different because fortune seeking and social climbing are different things. And I think that, again, is one of the things that really set the book apart to me. And I don't know your experience, you know, living there or writing this book, how you imagine like social climbing and fortune seeking to be different.
Oh, I love that. To me, yeah, Lagos is sort of a place, yeah, like Dick Whittington saying, "I'm going to London to seek my fortune." I think it's this idea we have that, you know, we can all make it. And it doesn't matter who we are or where we're from, that if we strive and we believe in ourselves, that we can make it. And Lagos attracts a huge number of driven people. It's sort of like the New York of Africa to me. And it's a similar type of kind of people who really, really believe in themselves and really, you know, they really have high goals, high standards for themselves. But then there's so many barriers to success in a place like Nigeria. It's not like New York, in that I feel like New York is more a place where talent really can find its way. And I'm a living example of that. But, you know, class and family and all these things thwart you in your goals. And in a sense, you're almost forced to be a social climber in Lagos, because so much of your success depends on more powerful people giving you an opportunity. And there are far less powerful people. So it means that people are very much concentrated on these sons of billionaires or the billionaires themselves, and really concentrated on these powerful families. So I think there's a real tragedy in that. And that is something I really wanted to expose in a way.
I think you did. And there was like a chaos to it. But it's one of those things where it's like, once you figure out the rule, there's like, I don't know, there's like a room where the rules are made, right? And it's like, everybody's trying to get to, I don't know, trying to figure out what they are. And I found that really intriguing as part of the thriller and part of the mystery of the novel, which is like, who's making these rules and why? And anyway, I found that part of the book really interesting. My next question for you is just around advice for authors. You know, we have tons and tons of authors, aspiring authors, published authors that listen to the show. And, you know, obviously we'd love any sort of wisdom, advice that you can give to authors. I know you've published in the YA category, in the adult category. So yeah, we would just love your words of wisdom that you'd love to share with our audience.
Ooh, okay. Well, I am still finding it tough in this industry. I think things that you are dealing with before you get the book deal, like imposter syndrome and finding it hard to get down the page, are things like most authors are always dealing with, no matter how far along they get in the process. So don't let these things put you off, and think of yourself really as a writer from the beginning and take your work seriously. I would also say, trust the thing that makes writing fun for you. We like to look at what's selling, and we like to look at, you know, what are the hot genres and what agents say they want. But, you know, when it's time for you to query, all that could have changed. And agents are so individual, and, you know, they're very seasonal as well in terms of what they're looking for. So I would really just trust the thing that's going to make you finish your work and make it something that you're very proud of and the best it can be. You know, I have had some really wonderful reviews, and I've also had some really negative reviews. And, you know, those negative reviews could really question yourself and make you think, oh, I shouldn't have done that, or like, I'm not a good writer. But at the end of the day, what I hold on to is that I wrote something that I really wanted to write, and that in a way I had to write. There was no other story for me to write. And I'm really proud of having written this story. And I'm really proud of the fact that the Niger wives have said, you know, we love the way you've captured the Niger wife experience, and that we're actually using your story to help us have a stronger sisterhood and support each other, because there are a lot of Nicoles in the Niger wives, and, you know, and we see that now. So I feel like out of writing this book, these are the things that I'm most proud of. And that's nothing to do with really, you know, book deals or like all the, you know, being lauded or whatever. You can't control really whether you get a book deal or not, or whether you get an agent or not, because it's so competitive and it's tough for everyone. But you can control like spending your time in an enjoyable way and writing stuff that you're really, really proud of.
Well, I think that's it, right? That's why we're all here, is just to work on things that excite us and that we're proud of. I also think, you know, from the perspective of longevity and legacy, right? It's like, you're going to look back on, you know, the titles you've worked on, and it says where you were at in your life. And it's just a beautiful legacy to leave over years of working on books and seeing authors, you know, be repeat authors and continue to grow that legacy. I think that's really special. So as I said, yeah, you published in YA and you published in adult. Do you know where you're going next in terms of, you know, the category or the genre that you want to work in?
Well, I'm staying in adult for the next book. I think after that, I'm interested in sort of that hybrid, like older child YA. I think I would like to tell, you know, a story a bit like my own version of sort of a Lord of the Rings or something like that, which I read as an older child. And I remember how magical it was to read that at that time. So that's something that interests me, but I still have to get through this next adult first.
Oh, yes, I know. It's the muddled middle when you're in the middle of it. You're like, I just need to make it to the other side. So I totally can empathize with that. And I'm sure a lot of authors listening can as well. Was there anything, you know, that I didn't ask you that you wanted to say about the book or the experience of being published?
Oh, gosh, it's just been really wonderful. It's bewildering. And I really appreciate so many writers who have reached out to support me during this process. I've had best-selling authors reach out to invite me for coffee. I've had award-winning authors reach out and come to my launch when they didn't have to, you know, and just be there for me. I've had debut authors also share their experiences with me. And I just really appreciate all that love. And I would say to writers that writing is solitary, but you don't have to be solitary, as in you have so many opportunities to have community, and go and find that community and enjoy that community because it's there.
I agree. Couldn't agree more. That's why we created this community, is because we believe community is everything.
Yeah, I love your community, Carly. You do so much for us as writers. You encourage us and you give us so much information, and you're totally indefatigable. I don't know how you do it, along with being an amazing agent. So thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I have this like mother hen quality to me where I just like, I want to gather everybody up and just protect them. I don't know, keep my little flock protected from the big bad publishing world sometimes. So that mother hen quality comes out in me. But thank you so much for making time to come on the show, Vanessa. We're so excited for you and your career. And I love the book so much. So everybody go grab The Lego Swipe. It's really excellent.
Thank you.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation.
This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com and look for the Beta Reader matchup tab. And please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be.